I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people helping parents cope with our deteriorating moral culture and spotlighting the dangers of artificial intelligence and making media disinformation and censorship even more extreme. Join us, sit back, and enjoy some free expression. Media Research Center has long done excellent work analyzing and identifying bias in the nation's major press outlets, but in recent years, the idea of media bias has become almost quaint. Today, dissenting information isn't so much distorted as simply eliminated along with those sources providing it. Cancel culture reigns now, so the Media Research Center has sprung into action. Joseph Vasquez is associate editor for MRC's Free Speech America initiative. Joseph, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking with you about this stuff.
Well, give us a picture of current conditions and what the Media Research Center is doing about it.
Well, you know, back then in the 1980s when we launched, you know, we were focused on media bias. Now, with the explosion of big tech and now artificial intelligence, the threat of indoctrination and censorship has now exploded onto the scene, and the MRC is on the forefront to hold these big tech companies accountable, especially now because it's not only disseminating information that's biased, but at the same time, it's censoring people for having different opinions. And we saw that reflected in the 2020 election. We saw that with the Hunter Biden laptop scandal. You couldn't share that story on social media at all without getting censored or possibly banned or locked in your account. You can't tweet things about being pro-life and protecting, you know, the unborn. You know, you would get censored on Twitter and Facebook. Why? Because they have pro-abortion views. And now with the explosion of artificial intelligence, this is going to take censorship to a completely different level. I've been saying this over and over and over again. Right now, we are literally living in Orwell's 1984 on steroids. That's where we are as a country. That's where we are right now. It's gotten so much worse. And sadly enough, I say it's going to get worse the more that AI is incorporated into the media and also social media's attempts to silence conservatives. It's going to get worse.
How does artificial intelligence make a difference? We've heard a lot about AI, but people aren't really clear on the implications of this technology.
Well, that's the problem. The fact that we don't know the implications of this kind of technology. I mean, we do know that it's created with human reason and human logic. That's how the algorithms are developed. But the point of artificial intelligence is that it's self-learning. It scrapes the internet for information. So what if people are starting to get censored now because they're identified by some artificial intelligence chatbot or something else and potentially being dangerous? We already saw with big tech censorship collusion with the government vis-a-vis Twitter that the government is willing to go behind the back door in order to communicate with these companies to censor disagreeable speech. So we know that's going on. So what's to say that the government is not going to try to create the same kind of scene as companies begin to incorporate artificial intelligence? We're literally crossing the Rubicon here. This is untouched power. And as this gets utilized to a massive degree, goodness gracious, I mean, the limits are endless, essentially endless, for how big tech and the left will be able to control the flow of information on the internet. It's absolutely Orwellian. I mean, George Orwell himself couldn't envision something as dangerous as this explosion of artificial intelligence onto the scene. It is a whole new different beast. And that's why the MRC has been doing its utmost to make sure that these companies are held accountable, because we have no idea how dangerous this could actually be in the long run. All we know is that we see the red flags, and they're pretty alarming red flags.
We've all grown up with the Orwellian specter hanging over us. We understand what motivates Big Brother, I suppose. But what's motivating these private companies? I, and I think a lot of other people, have trouble understanding what's in it for them.
Well, we do know that a lot of these big tech companies, you know, we were assuming that they were just operating privately. But if the Twitter files showed us anything, was that these companies are not exactly as free as they make it out to be. You know, so we do know that that government entities were communicating with Twitter behind the back door. What's to say that they're not doing that with Google as well? Google just came out with its own version of ChatGPT called Bard. If government is willing to do that with Twitter, what's to say it's not doing that with other big tech companies? Are big tech companies as free as they try to make themselves out to be? I would venture to say, no, absolutely not. And the Twitter files prove that. Mark Zuckerberg himself, said the quiet part out loud on the Joe Rogan podcast when he mentioned that the FBI had come to him and primed his organization to be on the lookout for any kind of anti-Biden content, and try to characterize it as Russian disinformation. So when the Hunter Biden laptop story broke, Facebook was already primed to censor that information. So it's not just simply big tech operating on its own. It's operating also in collusion with government entities as well to censor people. And if the government is willing to do that, I can guarantee you they will not stop. James Madison himself had warned in the Federalist Papers that power is of an encroaching nature. The federal government tasted the power of colluding with big tech. And now with the explosion of AI, I can guarantee you it's going to get even more dangerous.
Well, what are you guys doing with this Free Speech America initiative? How are you trying to counter all of this?
Well, we just created a new site, a database, if you will, called CensorTrack. And what we're doing is that we're monitoring every single documented case of censorship that we can find on the internet. People reach out to us via a contact form that we have on the website. It's called censortrack.org. And when we get notified, we'll reach out to these big tech companies. We'll put them on notice that we know that this is going on. As a matter of fact, one of our studies that was taken from our CensorTrack database was cited in the ongoing lawsuit by Missouri and Louisiana against the Biden administration for precisely coordinating with big tech to censor Americans. And they cited research that we had conducted based on CensorTrack. So we're making a difference. We're providing the tools needed for legislators and also attorneys general from different states to take action. So the MRC is putting a big spotlight on all of this. And the amazing thing is that a lot of these companies were doing a lot of this stuff, including big government collusion, behind closed doors. No one knew what was going on. And it took Elon Musk spending $44 billion of his own money to purchase a platform so that we would know that this stuff was going on. We would be none the wiser had Musk not done what he did. So now we know this is an entire deep state backdoor apparatus that is going on that we were not aware of before. So if government is willing to do that, I can guarantee you they're going to continue to do that, and they're going to step up their efforts to make sure that they can censor people that disagree with approved narratives, whether it be pro-life, whether it be climate change, whether it be elections, you name it. Government big tech collusion is just going to get worse. And now with AI, all bets are off.
What can people do to support you in your work? You certainly seem to be building a mass of very useful information. How can people help to put it into action and bring about change?
Well, you can visit us at censortrack.org. If you've been censored, if any of your listeners have been censored, reach out to us. We want to hear about it. And we're going to hold these big tech companies accountable. Look at our studies on CensorTrack. We publish all our studies based on different types of censorship across a litany of platforms. Share them with your local representatives. Share them with your state attorneys general. I mean, the Missouri and Louisiana are already leading the charge against big tech government collusion, citing our research. But we're providing the information. And, information is power. And you know what? Who else knows that? The government does as well. Big tech knows it as well, which is why they try to control it as much. Where if the American people are aware that this is going on, there is strength. There is strength in the American people knowing that their free speech rights are under attack, which is why we need to put a sunlight. The best disinfectant to evil is sunlight. So let's shine the spotlight. Let's shine the sunlight on all of this nefarious schemes that is going on.
And where can people go again to get this information and find out how to help?
You can go to censortrack.org. That is censortrack.org. And then you can also visit our media analysis site, newsbusters.org. MR Free Speech America has its own webpage there, and you'll find the latest on big tech censorship news. We're always publishing studies. We're always planning on doing new research. And we're going to shine a spotlight. We're going to do this together to hold big tech and the government accountable for this completely Orwellian apparatus that they set up.
Joseph Vasquez, Media Research Center, thanks for being with us and giving us some insight into this situation. This, I think, is probably the most critical issue we face at this point in our history.
Oh, absolutely. This is literally the precursor to Orwell's 1984 becoming reality. This is it. This is the Rubicon that was crossed. And the MRC is going to do everything it can to fight back.
Life has always been complicated, and human sexuality is probably its most complicated aspect. These days, the ways in which our erotic nature is expressed have become wildly imaginative, socially disruptive, and politically volatile. No organization has explored sex and gender conflicts more deeply than the Ruth Institute. That Louisiana-based organization is headed by Jennifer Roback Morse. Dr. Morse writes extensively on sex and human relationships. She does a regular online video show, and she's interviewed frequently on sex, family issues, parenting, education, religion, you name it. Jennifer Roback Morse is with us, and I have to ask, you've spent your career exploring what may be the most conflicted and perplexing area of human experience. How did you get onto this path?
I didn't mean to. Honest, I didn't mean to. I got interested in these topics because of the concerns that I had as a mother, as an adoptive mother and a birth mother. We had two children within 6 months' time. We adopted a little boy from a Romanian orphanage who was 2.5 years old when we got him. And then 6 months later, we gave birth to a baby girl. And that was in 1991, so that's how long ago this has been going on. Having those two kids at the same time in our home made it very, very clear to my husband and me that kids need their parents, okay? Kids absolutely need their parents. And so for a number of years, we were scrambling in place just trying to be parents, you know, and trying to deal with all of the issues that our son had and observe him and learn and communicate with other parents in similar situations. But my economics training and my social science training said to me, there's something bigger here than just your family. Our society is no longer supporting mothers and fathers doing the things that absolutely need to be done, not only for individual kids, but for the whole society. So, you know, the combination of the motherhood experience plus the social science training told me to start looking at public policies that were undermining the family somehow. And so that's how it began. I was really interested in kids and the fact that they need their moms and dads, and how can we make it so kids need get their moms and dads, you know. And that led to a whole exploration of the fact that the things we're doing prior to marriage, namely the hookup culture, is leading us to make it's making it almost impossible for people to get married and stay married. And if mom and dad can't get married and stay married, things are going to be a lot harder for the kids and then for society as a whole. So that's how it happened. And as you mentioned in your intro there, my work has gotten more and more involved, I guess you could say, because our sexual culture has deteriorated so badly.
Yeah, I'm glad that I'm not of an age where I'm raising kids now. I look at my children, and they fortunately are decently established, but my daughter has three kids, and it's a challenge to try and protect them from these incredible influences that are upon them all the time.
Yes, that's true, and I think it's long past time for us to stop being naive about it. You know, this is not some impersonal force of history that is just kind of swept in like a hurricane off the Gulf of Mexico or something. You know, it's not a natural thing. It's not a organic thing. The sexual revolution has been a top-down, elite-imposed revolution, really, from the very beginning. You know, from the very beginning, ordinary folk have been going about their business and then being told that what they're doing is either somehow not really right or the oppressive, or the taboos need to go away because those taboos are just oppressive and have no point. And actually, as we have been removing one sexual taboo after another, we find out, well, gosh, you know, telling people not to do things actually turned out to have a point. You know, when you remove the taboo, a lot of it's like taking the guardrails off of off of a cliff. Some people are going to go off that cliff. And that's what we're dealing with. Very few people, I think, want to confront it directly for what it is. And that's why it's so difficult, I think.
Why the Ruth Institute? How did that come about?
I had taught economics at the university level for about 15 years when our kids arrived. And eventually I had to give up on the idea that I was going to somehow be a full-time mom and a full-time university professor at the same time. So I left teaching in 1996. And, was full-time mother, and everything that I did that was writing or professional, anything like that, was kind of tucked in around the edges when I had time to do it. And so I kept my toe in the water, so to speak, and I certainly kept monitoring what was going on in the world, you know. But by 2008, my kids were grown. We had done our foster care bit, and as a family, we had outgrown doing foster care. You know, there's a season of life where that works for a lot of families. And so I was looking around for the next thing, and decided that the thing I wanted most and that would make the best use of my talents and be the best use of the best way to go about doing what I was trying to do would be to start my own institute. And so I started the Ruth Institute on my dining room table in 2008 in San Diego and haven't looked back.
Well, now you offer a wide variety of resources to try and help people cope with these various stresses and pressures. I know you have ebooks, courses, blogs, videos, podcasts, a wide array. You have a recent publication, an ebook titled The 5 Myths of Homosexuality. Tell me about that, if you would.
It's protecting your family from the top 5 gay myths. And we wanted to put together something that would help people, you know, kind of our age group, you know, people who are not in the middle of raising kids, but who have grandkids and kids that they're very concerned about and so on, to try to help people understand that a lot of what we've been told about homosexuality and the gay community and all these things, that these things are not true. And believing that they're true is leading us to do a lot of harmful things and blocking us from doing the things that would be healthy and helpful. And so we put this document together, and it's based on a lot of research that I've done over the years, research that my colleague, Father Paul Sullins, who's a sociologist and who's a research associate with the Ruth Institute, some of his original research is featured in this document and so on. And so we put this together in the hopes that it would be helpful to people, and people can easily get it by going to the Ruth Institute, pressing a couple of buttons, and it will be on its way to you through email.
Give us a little introduction. What are some of the myths that you address?
Well, so I start this thing off by basically saying, you know, there's the most basic myth, kind of the big picture overview of the whole thing, and that is that we have been told that sexual orientation is an innate, immutable characteristic, meaning that it's inborn, it can't change, and that is a big myth, and it's an important myth, because that is the key to the strategy, you could say, the legal and public policy strategy of the LGBT movement and all of their allies. And, you know, not everybody who promotes this is gay, obviously, as you surely know, you know. The whole of the sexual revolution is composed of a lot of different people with a lot of different interests, but they all agree on this point. Sexual orientation is an innate, immutable characteristic. Now, why is that important to them? If they can prove that, if they can convince people of that, then all of the anti-discrimination law that has built up over the years to protect African Americans descended from slaves, all of that law can be pressed into service to protect homosexual acts and homosexual persons, which is all of which is contestable, right? The idea, the Catholic Church holds that people aren't homosexual or lesbian. People may have same-sex attraction. People may have certain kinds of thoughts and feelings and persistent attractions and so on and so forth. But we never want to label the person as being a homosexual person or a gay person or a lesbian woman. You know, we want to say this is a man, this is a woman, and they have a pattern of thoughts and feelings and that present certain challenges and problems to them. But the idea that sexual orientation is itself an easily defined thing, that you can say people are born gay, you know, that's number one big myth. People are born gay. If you can say people are born gay, then you can say gay is the new black. You may have heard that phrase even, you know, gay is the new black. Actually, gay has nothing to do with black. Black and gay have nothing to do with each other, you know, honestly, when you get right down to it. And I have plenty of black people who will tell you that, you know, who are just aggravated to no end that their civil rights movement is being pressed into service for something that most of them don't even believe in. So that's the big picture, is to help people understand. Gay is nothing like black, if we could summarize it that way. And then you break that down into its pieces. What is sexual orientation? It's a lot more complicated than you think. Nobody's born gay. People can change patterns of thoughts and feelings and behaviors. People can change. It happens all the time. You know, and the attempt to change won't hurt you, contrary to what a lot of people think. So those are some of the big myths, and we got a lot of science, a lot of footnotes in this document to help people understand that we're not just making this up. This is not something put out by the bishops' conference or a bunch of theologians. This is something that we can back up with science and experience.
Of course, now we've gone so far beyond homosexuality. Homosexuality seems like so last century.
I know. It's crazy, huh?
We've entered the alphabet era now. We have an endless variety of sexual identities.
But they're based on some of the same mistakes, though, you know, to think of those things, you know, to the idea that a person can be a trans person, that they're born in the wrong body. That is metaphysical nonsense. That is physical nonsense. It is medical nonsense. It's just nonsense, you know. But the ground has been laid for it with the born that way fallacy. And interestingly enough, I don't know if this is something that you and your listeners are familiar with, but there's a wide open rift within the LGBT movement because the L's, the lesbians, are in open warfare with the transgenders.
Right.
Open warfare, absolutely, because the lesbians are like, wait a second, who's this guy in a dress coming to our music festival? What is this guy who claims he's a woman showing up at a battered women's shelter and expecting to be admitted there? No, this is not okay, you know? It really has gotten that bad that men who are convicted rapists claim that they're women, and they're being housed in women's prisons.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about a nightmare, being locked up with a sexual predator. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that. So the lesbians are in open warfare with the transgender guys, and the transgender activists refer to them, they have a mean name for them, they call them TERFs, trans-erasing radical feminists. That's what they call them.
How do we come back from this? I mean, is it even possible? All of the institutions of society seem to have either bought into it or been pressured into this ideology, and now it's impossible. It's impossible to watch TV without seeing shows and commercials that show a variety of sexual types. It's impossible to go into a store without encountering products that are oriented in this way. It seems like an overwhelming challenge.
Well, yes, it is. I would agree with that. But we're not allowed to say that there's no hope, okay? I mean, despair is a serious sin. And we as Catholics have to remind ourselves of that. Despair is a serious sin. And our ancestors in the faith have been through at least this bad or worse, you know? I mean, in a sense, we're reviving the Roman Empire, right? The decadence of the Roman Empire. And so we know that the church survived that. The church existed in catacombs for longer than the United States has existed under the Constitution as a nation, okay? So just have that in your mind, you guys. And you need to understand that nobody can save this situation. Nobody can salvage this situation without at least the help of Catholics and the Catholic Church. And probably it's going to be us who gets this straightened out. Although there are plenty of allies, plenty of people who are looking around going, what the heck is going on? And want to do something about it. If we don't do our part, I don't think they'll be able to succeed because we're the ones who are willing to go all the way to the core of the thing and look at the philosophical issues, the metaphysical issues, and go, this cannot work even in principle. You know, what the sexual revolutionaries are trying to do cannot work. It, no matter how much power they have, no matter how much money they have, no matter how much propaganda they pump out, this cannot work. And we can tell you why. And because we believe in God and the Holy Spirit, we know that it's possible to persevere in doing what God wants us to do, and he'll sort it out, you know. But that's our responsibility, you know. God put you and I in this time, in this place, to deal with this problem. And nobody's allowed to go AWOL, right? We all have to be involved.
At the same time, it doesn't seem like church leaders are terribly eager to confront these issues. I don't hear much about this stuff in church.
No kidding. What can I say? I mean, that's been a problem, really, I would say, since Humanae Vitae, the dissent over the birth control encyclical that was allowed to go unchecked, you know. We haven't fully confronted that or dealt with that. And honestly, the birth control issue is in many ways the core issue, because as soon as you cut the connection between the sexual act and childbearing, a lot of other things fall apart. You know, a lot of the other things that are holding us together fall apart. So you can't see, for example, that what is called the intersex person, the intersex person who has atypical genitalia or some type of hormonal situation, so that they're not typically male, they're not typically female. The trans activists trot those people out and say, see, that proves sex is not binary. That proves there's a spectrum. That proves that it's not, you know, that proves something. But the reality is that the people who have those conditions, that's a medically diagnosable condition, most of those people are sterile. Now, what does that mean, that they're sterile? It means that they're you can properly call it a disorder, because their reproductive body parts and all that that means, including their hormones and the body parts themselves, the body parts are not ordered to the end of reproduction. They don't work right. You know, it's like saying that some people are born blind, therefore eyes have nothing to do with seeing. You know, it's a nonsense kind of a thing to say. And so we're the ones who I think are going to be able to give people some of the clarity that they need to sort their way through the mass of deliberately created confusion that we're all dealing with.
Well, where can people go to find out more about your work and the Ruth Institute and the materials that you have available?
You can go to ruthinstitute.org, and right on the homepage, you'll be able to order this ebook, which is free and which will come to you automatically, I think. I hope. If it doesn't come automatically, let me know, because it's supposed to. That's the way it's supposed to work. But anyway, you can go to ruthinstitute.org and get the ebook. You will find that we have an active YouTube channel where we put up at least two videos a week. And we have a very active Facebook page where we have multiple posts per day. And we just got ourselves up on Twitter as well. But those are the most active places where you can be involved. And the nice thing about the Ruth Institute's material is that most of our stuff is what I would call evergreen. That is, you can read something from 3 years ago or 5 years ago, and it's still relevant. And so that's why it looks like we have so much stuff, because we don't have to throw any of it away, you know. It continues to be helpful. And in fact, it's sometimes very, very helpful to see that, gosh, 10 years ago, this problem was happening, and it's still happening, and the same things are still true about it.
RuthInstitute.org. Jennifer Roback Morse, thanks very much for taking time to talk with us.
I'm very glad to do it.
Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.